Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case for argument today is Saldino v. Envirac. Mr. Holmes.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel, my name is Ryan Holmes and I represent the appellant in this matter, Nicole Saldino. This cause comes before the Court following the District Court's granting of summary judgment on Ms. Saldino's four pending claims before it. Those pending claims were hostile work environment, sexual harassment, retaliation, disability discrimination, both failure to accommodate and disparate treatment. The sole issue before this Court today is whether the District Court erred in granting summary judgment on Ms. Saldino's failure to accommodate claim. We would ask this Court reverse and remand that cause of action for trial. In order for Ms. Saldino to be successful on a failure to accommodate claim, she must prove four elements. The first element is that she was disabled. This element is conceded before this Court. The second element which Ms. Saldino must prove is that the defendant was aware that she was disabled.
Mr. Holmes, before you go through, we do know those elements. What evidence would we find in this record to suggest that Envirovac's claim that, number one, they made the decision to conduct their reduction in force before many of the key events for Ms. Saldino, and most importantly, what evidence is there that their claim that her release was based on seniority is a pretext?
Very good question, Your Honor. If you examine the
record,
if you'll examine the record in this case, there's what the case law refers to as a telling temporal sequence. Ms. Saldino was released to return to work full-time, an accommodation which her supervisor, Dennis Tritt, said would have worked on October 8, 2001. She gives the release to the Director of Human Resources, Nancy Kolar, that same day. Ms. Kolar says that she has to check with Mr. Tritt and Doug Wallace, and she is terminated the next day. There is Seventh Circuit case law that states that the telling temporal sequence of one day and even one week is enough to prove causation. In addition to that, Your Honor, we have an issue with a layoff list. The defendant claims that there was one layoff list created, and that was by Ms. Kolar's testimony.
But actually the defendant also says that we have Wallace's deposition testimony saying that he had no idea that Saldino had this disability when he's creating the layoff list. How do we get around that?
Is the question whether the defendant...
He's the one who made up the list. This is all before your temporal sequence, which if I'm understanding you correctly, is the only evidence that you do have that might, in your view, suggest that the explanation of the company was pretextual.
Your Honor, Mr. Wallace testified at his deposition that he does not recall ever seeing a layoff list.
Well, he decides, though, that he's going to have this reduction in force. It's going to be on the basis of seniority, right? And you don't disagree that on a seniority basis she would be one of the people to go, if that were the real reason. I know that's not your position, but hypothetically, if that were the reason.
Hypothetically, seniority is a valid thing to use in a reduction of force.
It can be used, and she was low enough on the seniority totem pole that she would be the one to go.
That is correct, Your Honor. Okay. Another fact I believe that casts doubt upon Mr. Wallace's assertion that he made the decision in September of 2001, if he actually made that decision, he could have informed the plaintiff at that time.
Well, she was on leave then, wasn't she? On FMLA leave at that point?
She was, and I believe the record will show that she was about to come off in September and it was extended. And the record is unclear when in September Mr. Wallace actually made that decision. Furthermore, Ms. Saldino testified that the contracts at issue here, which would justify a reduction in force, all the contracts were either for 1, 5, or 10 years. And Ms. Saldino said that she was not aware of any contracts being canceled. If you'll examine the record, there were never any contracts put in the record which would show that they were, in fact, canceled. We just have Doug Wallace's statement saying that the contracts were canceled. And if you read the district court's opinion, the district court says that Ms. Saladino's statements are self-serving. I would submit to the court that they're no more self-serving than Mr. Wallace's statements that the contracts were
well,
canceled.
She doesn't have personal knowledge of that, though, does she?
Your Honor, I would submit to the court that in a business such as this, if you lose a contract, I mean, we're talking about major airline companies and their vacuum systems for the waste disposal. I would submit that in a company such as that, it would be common knowledge if an event like that would happen. It would be such a major event, a contract being canceled. I would submit to the court that it's reasonable to assume that Ms. Saladino would have some sort of notice.
But it would have been secondhand knowledge. I mean, she's not the corporate officer in charge of
that is
contracts.
True. That is true. We believe further proof that disability was a motivating factor in this case is that the defendant failed to engage in the interactive process. Kolar indicated that she wanted to speak with Mr. Tritt and Mr. Wallace regarding the possibility of an accommodation, and I believe Mr. Wallace's testimony was that there were no alternatives. Mr. Tritt's testimony was that he never had any conversations with Kolar. And it goes back to the fact that one day after she submits her request for accommodation, she is, in essence, terminated.
But, of course, the company offers a reason for that one day. Well, the presence and then, well, first the absence, then the presence of the asterisk next to her name, in that because she was on FMLA leave, they hadn't notified her yet, and they didn't want the other employees calling her up and saying, guess what, you know, you've just been riffed.
That is correct, Your Honor. But
that's the kind of thing you would have to suggest some reason for us to think that was pretext, too, wouldn't you?
The fact that Ms. Kolar, the HR representative, affirmatively stated that there was only one list, and we have two lists in evidence.
Well, it depends what you think of as a list. I mean, there is an indication. She's saying that she was always on the list and that it's just that the asterisk appears after she's been notified. In other words, she's told about it later. Is that the same thing as two different lists, in your opinion?
In our opinion, it is, Your Honor, that Ms. Kolar testified that there was only one list created. Ms. Saladino received a list on the 9th from a co-employee. That list did not have an asterisk by her name. After she submits the request for accommodation, when she comes in the following day, there is a second list with an asterisk by her name. Our position is that is two different lists,
okay,
Your Honor.
Do we know why her co-employee gave her the list?
No, we don't, Your Honor. That information is not in the record. I would submit to the court that they are probably friends, but I don't believe there's anything in the record. I would submit to the court that for the causation element in a disability, a failure to accommodate claim, it must be a motivating factor, not the only factor. It has to be the catalyst which causes the employment action. I would submit that the telling temporal sequence, along with the two layoff lists, the failure to engage in the interactive process, and what I consider an issue of fact regarding the length and cancellation of the contracts is enough for Ms. Saladino to prove that the disability caused the adverse employment action. Your Honor, I see that I've entered the rebuttal time. May I briefly conclude?
Fine, thank you. Based upon
the facts, arguments, and law in plaintiff's appellant brief and my oral argument here today, I would respectfully request this court reverse the district court and remand Ms. Saladino's failure to accommodate claim for trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Holmes. Mr. Vinson.
Good morning. May it please the court, Joshua Vinson on behalf of the defendant appellee Envirovac, Inc. We're talking about essentially two of the four elements of this ADA claim, whether the defendant was aware of the plaintiff's disability and whether the disability caused the adverse employment action. I think the court's initial question right out of the chute is the dispositive point. The testimony is undisputed that Doug Wallace, who was the decision maker in this case, had no knowledge of the plaintiff's disability. And when you look at this factually, it's almost on point with the Hedberg versus Indiana Bell case, because Mr. Wallace is at least two levels above the plaintiff, I think perhaps three. He has no day-to-day contact with her at all. That's very similar to the decision maker in the Hedberg case. He had no opportunity, because of the lack of contact with her, to have any knowledge that she suffered from seizures. In fact, I think the record indicates she only had one seizure at work, and the only person who ever saw that was the HR director, Nancy Kolar. So Mr. Wallace has no knowledge of the seizures.
As I understand it, though, Mr. Holmes is taking issue with the question whether Mr. Wallace really is the singular decision maker here or whether Ms. Kolar and her knowledge and information and views have to be attributed somehow to him, or maybe she is the decision maker.
There's nothing in the record to substantiate that. Mr. Wallace's testimony was unequivocal that in terms of the process, there is an annual budget review that occurs each year. And then in August, he received a directive that they were to reduce costs. And in September, in response to that directive, he made decisions in terms of who was going to be laid off. He made those decisions based strictly on seniority. Secondary consideration was productivity of the employees. Nancy Kolar, the HR person, testified that she had no input in that decision-making process. In fact, Wallace said when the managers at his level, his peers, met to discuss this process, their discussions were with the people senior to them, and Kolar was junior to him. So there is nothing that the plaintiff can identify in this record that would create some link between Kolar and Wallace with respect to the decision that would facilitate knowledge of the plaintiff's disability. So it doesn't really exist.
What about, bearing in mind, obviously, as you certainly know, that the standard on summary judgment review requires us to take the facts and inferences most favorable to the party opposing, mm-hmm. What about these two lists? I mean, you have, in fact, offered an explanation, which,
sure.
which we know, but taking the facts most favorably to her, should we see this as, oh boy, you're going to be gone for a longer time, you're only volunteering to come back for 20 days part-time, or whatever other reasons there might have been, maybe we'll just add an asterisk next to your name, too?
Sure. No, I understand your point exactly. I think the one thing that I would correct about the question you asked counsel about that issue is, and this I think is, again, a dispositive point, is that the list with the asterisk wasn't created by the decision maker. In your question, Judge Wood, you characterized it as if Doug Wallace had created this list. But in fact, the testimony by Nancy Kolar, page 25 of her deposition, was that she created the list. So from the standpoint of who created the list and who put the asterisk by it, it wasn't the decision maker who did it. So to me, that sort of severs any kind of possibility that the list is somehow a reflection of an after-the-fact decision when plaintiff says, oh, I want to come back to work, that the decision maker suddenly said, oh, well, let's add her to the list. And that's, again, consistent with the corporate hierarchy. It's consistent with the process by which they tried to notify people. I mean, the list didn't have people's names on it. I think there was at least some sensitivity to that aspect by publishing it so that it only identified job title and birth date, so you could figure out who you were, but not necessarily who else was terminated. So I think Kolar's separate decision-making process, if you will, the only connection there is that the request for an accommodation, all that caused was how plaintiff would be notified of her termination. It didn't cause the termination itself. It just affected the method by which she was going to be notified of it.
Because could you please remind me of what evidence, other than Mr. Wallace's deposition, there is in the record to show what set of people were going to be released as of September? I mean, was there a document that said, here are the following names or positions or anything, or is it really Mr. Wallace's deposition?
My understanding, my recollection is that it was primarily Mr. Wallace's deposition. I know that he mentioned some type, I believe in his deposition, mentioned a spreadsheet of some sort that he created, because obviously he had to have some knowledge of people's seniority.
Yeah, presumably he wasn't holding it all in his head.
I hope not.
I don't know.
And again, there's a lot of overwhelming evidence that, reinforces the consistency of what occurred here. I mean, the company had 130 employees, I think 132 employees in 2001. The decision to make this reduction in force occurred pretty much on the heels of 9/11. They were a big supplier for the airline industry. They provide the waste systems on airplanes. We know there's been a huge cutback in purchasing airplanes. It affected the economy enormously. And it all fits because over the course of 2 or 3 years, the reduction in force, they went from 132 employees to 102. So it's not as if, the plaintiff was, isolated on and terminated in this case. And it's consistent with the fact that she lacked the seniority. And the inability, really, to link up the list with the asterisk on it to Mr. Wallace, I think is really fatal to the case. From the standpoint of the second element, causation, I think the dispositive case there is Foster. And the Foster decision, makes it clear that temporal proximity standing by itself is not enough. And, and we come back to the legitimate reasons that were offered here by EnviroVac for the termination, the fact that plaintiff was conceded by counsel among, if not the least senior person on the list, the second least senior person on the list of roughly 10 that were terminated. So there's nothing really to impeach that reason and suggest that it was a pretext for any type of discrimination.
Is there anything in the record that would tend to show that the neutral RIF criteria of seniority or lack of seniority was applied in anything other than an even-handed way?
No, there isn't. I think from the testimony of the plaintiff herself in her deposition, she was well aware that most of the people who were terminated, it appears, were less senior people, although there is testimony from Mr. Wallace in his deposition that a secondary criteria for his decision process was productivity as well. So, unless the court has other questions, we would ask that you affirm the judgment.
Thank you, Mr. Vincent.
Thank you.
How much time? You have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
First point I'd like to make is we stand by our proposition that since the defendant did not argue that they were not aware of the fact that she was disabled, they've waived it on appeal. As for the causation element, which is the central issue of this appeal, as for the second element regarding productivity, the record will show that Ms. Saladino was meeting the employer's legitimate expectations and that she also had just received a positive evaluation in the spring just before she came down with her pseudo-seizures and other ailments. As for the list, which I believe to be the central piece of evidence, although Kolar created the list, she had to get the names from someone. I submit to the court that a reasonable inference is that Doug Wallace told her who was going to get laid off, and she created that list. And the first list, which Ms. Saladino...
But how does that help you? Because if you have to go back to Wallace, then don't you fall into the trap of what Wallace knew when he made those decisions?
Your Honor, I would submit to the court that he knew that she was disabled. And I would also submit to the court...
Is there any evidence of that in the face of his deposition testimony to the contrary?
I believe there is if you look at the plaintiff's statement of facts, and the district court found there was sufficient evidence as well that Doug Wallace was, or the defendant, I should say, was aware the plaintiff had a disability, which would be imputed to the decision maker. Your Honors, in this case, we have a telling temporal sequence, a failure to engage in the interactive process, an issue of fact regarding whether, in fact, there was a downturn in business regarding the contracts, and I believe that when you look at the entire mosaic, which is what the case law refers to it as, that Ms. Saladino has painted a mosaic sufficient enough to get her to a jury of her peers on her claim. And for the foregoing reasons, I would ask that the judgment of the district court be reversed and remanded for trial.
Thank you, Mr. Holmes. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. We'll move to the second case this morning.